hppodcraft.com.
Kay did her best to follow Sanderson's example, but it wasn't easy. There was so much she wanted to know, so much she wanted to understand. Had her last dream been precognitive or symbolic of reality? The empty crypt beneath the awesome opening, did that mean Cthulhu had been destroyed? Obviously so, if Mike was returning. She remembered Lovecraft's story, how the ship had rammed the monstrous creature, ripping its slithering shape asunder, only to have its substance recombine. Still, there were no nuclear weapons in Lovecraft's day. Now, even alien life forms couldn't withstand atomic disintegration. Don't think about it. Don't ask questions. Besides, there isn't time.
Speaking of an awesome opening, that was a selection from Strange Eons by Robert Block, and we're about to conclude Blocktober here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're at hppodcraft.com and Patreon. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. That reader once again was Andrew Lehman. Don't forget to visit the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society at hplhs.org for movies, radio dramas, merchandise, and props, all of which were discovered in an empty warehouse in Boston, and you could possibly get killed by a cult if you buy them, but please go check it out.
Yeah!
There's good
stuff.
Come
on, what's a little cult killing to all the hours of enjoyment that you can get from the products at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society?
The briefness of your life makes the treasures all the more delicious. What's this music we're listening to?
Once again, our music has been provided by Repairer of Reputations from the album The Night Ocean. It's available on Bandcamp, and we'll link out to it on the show notes.
We've been playing that all month. It's great stuff. Please go check it out. Give it a listen. Give it a purchase.
Yeah.
Chris, I don't know if you've been reading the news since we did that last episode. Frankenstein's monster, I guess, is still ravaging comedy clubs across the countryside.
What?
Yeah, he's been doing tight 5-minute sets and then leaving before Victor can get into the club to see him.
Oh, God.
There's a clip I got from the news.
Okay, yeah.
Hey, you ever notice everything a family does as you hide in a shack outside of their home? You ever notice that? What's up with that? Wow, do you hear that crowd laughing? They love it. That was at Go Bananas Comedy Club in Cincinnati. I mean, you could tell the audience is loving it, but by the time Victor got there, the monster was gone.
Of course.
The thing is, Victor still has to meet the 2-drink minimum before he can leave again.
Oh, jeez.
That's how the monster stays one step ahead of me.
But why does Victor drink the drinks? He doesn't have to drink them.
They're very strict at those places. He's got to sit down and watch Shuggy Duggy and drink his 2 drinks. Every once in a while, he'll get lucky and someone will pop in, you know, a Seinfeld or a Janine Garofalo. But
wow.
Mostly, it's a lot of bad open mic comics. Yeah, the monster's really torturing him.
Being in LA, we went a couple times to go see some open mic stand-up comedy, and I didn't realize how bad stand-up comedy could be.
Yeah, I know.
I remember one where it was a guy, this is his opening bit right here. He goes, man, my ex-girlfriend, she was a bitch. That was it. That was his joke. I don't understand.
I think Frankenstein's Monster does a bit that's kind of like that, where he goes, my ex-girlfriend was ripped to shreds by the man who created me. And it's funny, but I feel like he's got to punch it up a little bit. He's doing these open mics so he can work out the material. Yeah. Sometimes it's just the punchline's not obvious yet.
Obviously, he's doing this observational comedy, as you would call it.
Yes, yes.
Maybe his perspective isn't as easily shared by most of the audience.
It's hard to relate to him because he's, you know, he's not human. Where are we in the story, Strange Eons?
We pick up the story with Kay packing her things for her trip back from Washington to Los Angeles.
She's excited because this time she's going to take a trip and they're going to allow her to be conscious. She's like, I'm going to catch up on some reading. I'm going to listen to some podcasts. I'm not going to be handled by strangers against my will. This is going to be a sweet trip.
She's also excited about finding out what exactly happened to Relay during the nuke run and to see her lover, Mike, the Delta Green agent, not really Delta Green.
It's not explicitly stated that it's Delta Green.
No, but it's Delta Green.
But she wants to hear from Mike, and she's in love with him. She says, we only met 3 days ago, but they were glorious days. On the first, he lied to me and assumed the identity of a dead man. On the second, he transported me across the country to his apartment while I was unconscious, and then recorded me while I slept. And on the third, I fell in love. Who wouldn't?
It makes no sense.
Sanderson, the agent in charge of protecting her, and Kay take a personal jet. It's just him and her with a pilot and a co-pilot. They have some food on the plane, and she notes that none of the newspapers have said anything about the nukes going off, so there must have been some big government cover-up with the whole thing. She thinks about Lovecraft and wonders if he was psychically sensitive, like the protagonist in his stories. I think Block tries to do a little Lovecraft racist retcon here.
Yeah.
Saying that all of his talk about mongrels and lower humans were really actually about Deep One hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
So see, he wasn't racist. He was talking about Deep One hybrids.
It's a funny section. She's thinking, people have always thought Lovecraft's hatred of seafood led to him writing Innsmouth, but what if it's the other way around? He experienced those things, and that's why he hates seafood. Same with not liking the cold. It's not that drove him to write Cool Air. It was experiencing, I don't know, the Mountains of Madness made him not like cold. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And then she goes, and the mongrels? It's just hinting. It was his way of warning about monster-human mating. It was never real racism.
No.
And this does actually come up a lot in the story, this whole idea that it was his racism was kind of a metaphor for monster-human mating.
Right.
I was a little slow on the uptake, though, because he's actually foreshadowing something.
Yes.
We'll get to that. But there was a comment on our first episode from Rave Wolf, and it said, oh. I read this one as a kid by way of the public library. If I remember correctly, some versions have a preface by Block that includes some defensive notes on HPL.
Oh.
And the speculation that had he lived longer, he would have gotten further out of his shell and been more accepting of people over time. I sort of bought it at the time, but now think it may include some wishful thinking.
Yeah.
But there were notes by Robert Block in some editions where he calls this out specifically.
So Sanderson, he's yawning. So Kay tells him to, you know, go in the back and sleep. There's a little bed back there. And he's not supposed to. He's supposed to be on guard duty, but she knows he hasn't slept for like days. So she just insists. And they're on a plane alone. What could happen? They're in the, you know, the middle of the air. They're 20,000 feet in the sky.
Yeah.
So he goes down for a kip.
There's a bedroom on this plane. It's that fancy of a private jet, which I wanted to go in there and take a nap myself, not have to read the rest of this book. It just sounds so appealing.
Now, wait, come on now. I'm
kidding. I was enjoying this.
As ridiculous and stupid as a lot of this stuff is, it moves at a really fast clip. I don't know what's going on, and I'm totally interested the whole way through. So.
No, that's true. This is definitely different than books that are hard to get through because they're boring or something. Yeah. This is just absurdity piled on absurdity, but it's super enjoyable the whole time.
Oh, yeah. So after his nap, he feels much better, and then he starts talking about Lovecraft. He says that Lovecraft knew the truth and that Nye distorted it for his own ends. The old ones created life and humans for food, but not to literally eat, but to feed off their fear.
Right. There's a passage that says, men were bred for fear, just as they themselves bred plants and animals selectively for their own most desirable qualities. From time to time, new strains were added to what mankind in its vanity calls the human race.
So sometimes humans would mate with other things to create better, more fear-rich life?
Yeah, it says the blending of blood resulted in hybrids with a heightened capacity for emotional response, which was strange. Does that mean ghouls and deep ones get scared easier? It's a weird notion.
Sanderson sounds all crazy talking about this stuff because she's never heard him say any of this kind of stuff before.
Right.
And he says, never before has the world been so full of fear, and the old ones need that. The time for their return is soon, and they will need to feed. Mm. And then she kind of just looks at him and she goes, you're not Sanderson. And when she says that, he goes, yep, you're right. I'm not Sanderson. And then she's like, what happened? And he goes, well, while Sanderson slept, I did a mind transference with him. And she goes, just like the thing on the doorstep.
It's sort of like thing on the doorstep, but that was like that slow erosion of the guy's personality by his wife. This was just
a mind swap.
A simple mind swap. Because it says the person that's taken over is merely one of the many who serve. So it's not some great wizard. It's
no, just some guy.
It's a soldier.
Yeah, it's Trevor.
I don't remember that scene in Thing on the Doorstep where he mind swapped with somebody who's on an airplane. Like, how does it work long distance like that?
No, I don't think it does. But, you know, he's changing things up. Maybe it's a more refined version. It's like a level 7 spell as opposed to a level 5 spell.
Oh, it's level 7. Okay.
So he explains that they aren't going to LA. They're going somewhere else. And Kay faints again.
Really, Mr. Block, your faint work has surpassed mine in every way. Such good faint work. But as she's passed out, they also drug her, I think. That she says she feels a needle in her arm, so they're keeping her asleep.
She comes in and out of it as they travel. She hears fragments. Kay's part of Nye's plan. Somehow they found out about the nuke plan and arranged things accordingly. Something about not dealing with a Lavinia.
This strange cultist who's now occupied this guy's mind is talking the whole time that she's in this dream state, telling her, you know, initially they made contact with her because she was Albert Keith's wife and they wanted to see how much she knew. But they could have let her go, actually, once they found out she didn't know anything, but she got involved with Miller. And now she's been chosen for something. They took over this plane because they need her now.
So when she wakes up, they tell her that they are at Easter Island. They land the plane and the place is devastated, but there are lots of people with torches. Not just islanders, but people from all nationalities.
It's a big culty King Kong kind of scene. They're obviously all preparing for some ritual.
So Reverend Nye is there and he welcomes her and she notices that his gloves are off because he always wore those white gloves. Mm-hmm. And that when she sees his hands, the palms of his hands are black. And then she looks at him in his face again. And, you know, she notices that his lips are black and his gums are black and the flesh around his eyes are black. And he's not human. He tells Kay that Miller is dead. Now is the time to bring order to chaos. The stars are right. They make the final preparations. There's a big ritual going on the seaside. Drums, fire, all that stuff. They chant, "Behold the bride."
The bride. I did not know they were going to go there with it. I thought this was just going to be a repetition of her being thrown in a hole or something.
She thinks about something that they said, you know, about a Lavinia. And then she goes, "Oh, Lavinia Whateley from Dunwich Horror. She had offspring with Yog-Sothoth." And it dawns on her, she is to be the bride of Cthulhu.
Kay opened her eyes, and as she did so, the foggy curtain ahead began to part. Something was moving in the mist. It rose, huge, black, oozing and bubbling forth from the great volcanic crater where it had watched and waited, its squamous shape silhouetted against the stars as it wriggled up and out, flowing toward her. A single glimpse caused her to scream so loudly that she did not hear the drums, the chanting, or even the sound of the approaching planes overhead. They flung her forward. Then the writhing appendages extended to embrace her, and she knew no more.
She got married to Cthulhu?
Yeah, I guess it's actual legally binding ceremony, you know?
Seems like an expensive wedding, too. That many guests, torches.
Nye got ordained online, so he was able to do it officially.
Oh, is that...
And Cthulhu, he was nervous about the ceremony because, you know, he wrote his own vows.
Yeah.
You know, he's not a poet.
No, he's...
He spoke from the heart.
Is her name Kay Cthulhu after that?
She's a modern woman, so she probably actually kept her...
Well, yeah, we'll see. She's a model, though. She's probably like, I'd probably get a lot further if it was Kay Cthulhu. I could see her making a decision like that.
Yeah, I could see that.
People know that name.
Yeah, you got branding with it.
They actually did this with Sabrina in those Afterlife with Archie comics.
What?
Yeah, there's, and I haven't read that far in them. Remember, we were talking about that on earlier.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. She marries Cthulhu?
Yeah, there's a whole thing. You can just look up Sabrina, Bride of Cthulhu, and you'll see the splash page.
Oh, my God.
So I don't know if they got that from this or...
I bet you they did.
She actually, it looks like this. It's got the big ritualistic kind of King Kong deal, and then...
Oh, wow.
And then she marries Cthulhu. It's a weird thing because Lovecraftian gods are very non-human.
Yeah.
A wedding is a very human thing to do, but I guess it's just the cultists doing this as a ritual so that they can consummate their relationship or whatever. I do think that the bride of the monster is, you know, it's in mythology where women would either get impregnated by the gods, or you think about Persephone was abducted by Hades, who made her his wife. I think she was only able to leave in the summers after some trickery. That's how they explain the seasons. But, you know, or even King Kong, where they tie Fay Wray up and the monster's supposed to come out and marry her. So there's a lot of precedent for this. It just seems like a really odd juxtaposition with Lovecraftian gods. It also seemed like the cult was pretty successful, and it's only having just heard that clip again that I realize built in there, it says she didn't even hear the sound of approaching planes overhead.
Oh, right, yeah.
So as the ceremony's going on, I think those are the bombers who are coming in to nuke the place.
We find out about that in the final chapter, chapter 3, which is titled Soon.
Yes.
So we are 25 years into the future, so it's around 2003.
It took me a bit to figure out that it was the future. I mean, it gets solved within the first couple of pages, but I was a little thrown off at first. It was the phone booth with the two-way screen that allowed me to figure it out.
Yes.
Wait a minute, he's doing Jetsons technology here. Okay, yeah. This is the future. Or the future in 1978.
Which actually is pretty accurate. Didn't we have Skype in 2003?
Yeah, I think video conferencing was starting up around then.
So our new protagonist is this guy, Mark Dixon. He's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's in a hotel lobby on the vidphone with his editor, and then shooting starts. Someone is attempting to kill the mayor. The assassin is killed right away. His face is blown off. Again, Block hates faces.
There's so many faces getting ripped off and blown off and tops of heads getting shot away. He hates faces.
So the editor has him come back to the newspaper to give a full report after he finds out what he can there.
Yeah, and then we get this whole interview scene where the hard-nosed editor interrogates him about, all right, tell me what happened. Stuff it with your random details. I want to know the basic, simple story.
So it turns out that this hitman was a pro. He had his fingerprints removed. He had a great disguise, but he just had a pistol, which is kind of strange. Mm. The mayor got a threat on the vidphone by a guy in a ski mask that morning, but it wasn't specific. So he continued with his plans, and the cops believe he's part of the Black Brotherhood.
Right. The assassin.
Yes.
And it's strange because with all of that, you said, you know, his fingerprints were removed and his disguise, he was clearly a professional. But as you say, he went after him with a clunky handgun. He also did this in the middle of a hotel lobby where there was a big chance of him getting taken out before he accomplished his goals.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why didn't he use a sniper? Apparently it was a publicity thing. We're not sure, but it's an answer nobody really gets, including the reader. And I got to say, there's a lot of talk about assassinations and political targeting in this book as part of this Cthulhu cult's plot. But I don't really know what the point of that is, because it doesn't seem necessary for them to accomplish, you know, this marriage. Or
what I think is explained later is that it's all to kind of keep the governments off the cult.
Yes.
So any government agency that starts messing with the cult, they take them out.
It's targeting people who are in the know, or perhaps even doing big geopolitical things to distract folks so they're not paying attention to what.
Yes. But that's explained later in the story. So now we go to the house of Mark Dixon's adopted father, this guy Judson Muybridge. We find out he was adopted, and I'm like, oh, adopted, you say? We don't know who his parents are. I wonder how this is going to play out. Mm-hmm. And we also find out that Mark is about 25 years old.
I'm sad to admit that it took me a little bit to figure out what was going on here. I did. I don't know why. I guess I'm like a Lovecrafting protagonist where the implication was just so absurd that my mind wasn't allowing it to creep in there. But then, yeah, at some point I went, wait a minute, he's 25? Oh, this is 25 years in the future? What happened? Oh, no.
Muybridge is a powerful lawyer and seems to have written a book disproving the Lovecraft stuff, saying that it was all a hoax, that some people believed it was real, but it wasn't real. It was just some guy who wrote fiction. Through some very clunky exposition, we find out that the earthquakes happened, but everyone believes they were all just mundane things. The supernatural stuff wasn't connected to it. And the people that did bring it up, it was just some part of a hoax. Muybridge is the guy who wrote the definitive book on the myth of HPL. It's called The Fall of Cthulhu.
Fall of Cthulhu, which is a comic book series, isn't it? I don't know it if is, they, yeah. they lifted that from. But it's a very clunky scene, as you say.
Oh.
I gotta admit, you know, here we are at the end of the book. The first two parts played out almost exactly the same in some ways. Obviously, the details were different, but it was people slowly discovering that all this stuff was real and then them getting thrown somewhere in Relay.
Mm-hmm.
I just was like, why should I care about any of this that's going on right now?
Yeah.
Apparently the 78 Cthulhu massacre didn't happen. They stopped it, but I'm just assuming, well, it'll happen again, right? The stars will be right again, and it's just going to repeat itself.
So Mark tells Muybridge about the assassination attempt and the link to the Black Brotherhood. Muybridge is adamant that they are just nut jobs and they know nothing. Mark can tell he's lying, but he can't figure out why. It seems when Muybridge was writing his book, the young Mark read some Lovecraft. But now Lovecraft books are all hard to find. They're all out of print, and copies are super rare. Almost seems as if there's some conspiracy to get all of that stuff off the market.
Right.
And Muybridge is so angry about Mark's questions that he kicks him out.
Their relationship was really strange.
Yeah.
It didn't really seem fatherly to me.
No.
But he acts very weird and says, get out of here. It was very obvious that Muybridge is complicit in all this cover-up somehow.
Sure.
What's funny to me is the notion that you need to ban all of Lovecraft's work to keep people from reading it. You know, Locke has some pretty optimistic view of reading habits in 2003. I think the biggest barrier to people reading books by H.P. Lovecraft are the fact that they're books.
Yes.
Past that, the way that they're written is also a limiter to whether people are going to dive in or not. This isn't like Dan Brown writing these stories where they're super accessible. So I thought that was a funny notion. Oh, yeah, we had to ban all that stuff. The demand was just too high.
So Mark has this bad headache and he's heading over to his girlfriend's house. He's thinking about his investigation and he has an inkling of a cover up by the government. From what he can figure out, Cthulhu came out of Relay and moved to Easter Island and then the whole thing was nuked. There's a rumor that Cthulhu didn't die, but that he went back to sleep and would rise again. Mm. The Black Brotherhood is its agents. He reminds himself that black was not for their skin color, but for their use of black magic. Really glad he spelled that out for us because I assumed he meant black magic. I didn't assume he meant black people. That was kind of a weird,
it was really weird, yeah,
thing to say.
Well, also, black is in magic, not race, Mark reminded himself. So this is something he's got. He always gets confused when he sees the term black magic. What does that mean again? Is that magic by black people? No, it's evil. Okay. Always have to remind myself of that. In that same paragraph, he says, naturally, the group must have a normal proportion of non-Caucasians, particularly in Los Angeles, where the population was presently 22% black, 7% oriental, and over 30% Hispanic.
What?
And a little off with that one. Yeah, the actual Los Angeles is half Latino.
Yeah.
It's really only 30% Caucasian, actually.
Yeah.
10% Asian, so he wasn't totally off there.
Oh.
It's only 10% African American these days.
Huh.
It's been declining over the years as rents and home prices shoot through the roof.
Oh,
and
yeah,
a lot more people that had migrated here are actually migrating back to the South.
Hmm.
Los Angeles is losing a lot of its African American population.
Boo. It's a funky night, and he goes up to her apartment. It's right next to Parkland Cemetery. Sure, that's not going to come up at all in the story.
Oh, man, I was glad to see a graveyard. I thought that you know, usually you start with a graveyard before you get to gigantic worldwide conspiracy, but for some reason this book's going the opposite direction.
Change it up a bit.
I thought maybe he'd bring some of the Hound into it or something like that. So I got a little excited.
I thought so too, but no. His girlfriend, Laurel, takes him in and he tells her about his day.
They discuss his adoption a bit, how he has no idea where he's really from or who his parents really were. They establish that he was adopted by Moybridge. There's a conversation. Why didn't he ever have children? He was gay, right? Nope, sterile. The only two reasons he wouldn't have kids. Moybridge, he has a law practice, but he dropped out for a while he was writing this Lovecraft book. And then he never spoke of it again. There was a curious thing here. The girlfriend, Laurel, says, you know, everybody's edgy these days. It's not just the terrorist thing either. Look at all those items about continental shifting or whatever it is. I was reading something in a news magazine just the other day about nuclear waste polluting the atmosphere and changing the climate, what they call the greenhouse effect. They say we may be due for another series of earthquakes like the ones 25 years ago, or even worse. Thought it was a little forward-thinking in 78 to make a nod to climate change there.
Yeah, look at that.
Also lets you know it's been going on a long time.
He's feeling frisky and he wants to get it on, so she's up for it, and then they do it. There's some saucy writing here. It says, her lips had the faint flavor of cleansing cream, but that in no way decreased the sudden, surprising surge of pressure in his loins as he held her slight form close. His hands were already fumbling with the buttons of her robe.
Yeah.
We don't ever get any of that in any Lovecraft stories, let me tell you.
No, this was a sex scene. What a man that the flavor of cleansing cream didn't turn him off immediately, as it does for most men.
They do it, and then they go to sleep, but are awakened by an earthquake.
Oh no, it's happening again.
They run out of the house. It's a huge earthquake. There's fires, down power lines. His car's flipped over.
I think they see a homeless guy running around with his beard and hair on fire. That was a pretty crazy image.
That happens. They watch as her apartment collapses and bursts into flames. They run into the cemetery for safety. It's foggy and creepy. Laurel is scared, but there's nothing to fall on them. So they're like, okay, this should be pretty safe. They're just going to go through it. But then they see a lot of open graves and they hear some cackling laughter. And out of the fog, they see a ghoul.
A ghoul, yes. There's lots of open fissures in the ground that they almost fall into. But it's exposing tunnels that must have already been there. When the ground fell in. It said a strange canine face came out of the mist, and I thought, ooh, it is the Hound. But no, it's a ghoul.
The book did start off with a ghoul painting, so
yeah,
it never did deliver any ghoul. So it's finally coming correct on that.
You know, that's that old story instruction. If you show a ghoul in the beginning, make sure that ghoul goes off by the third act.
So Laurel, she freaks out and just runs off. Mark chases after her, but he loses her in the fog, and then he hears her scream. As he runs to where she's screaming, it's a mausoleum, but he trips over a fallen tombstone and he knocks himself on the head. And he almost passes out, or maybe he doesn't know. But when he gets up, the mausoleum is quiet, it's pitch black inside. And as he walks in, he feels his foot hit her robe and body.
She lay unmoving, and he did not breathe her name again. Instead, he stooped quickly and gathered her limp form in his arms. She was so slight that he had no difficulty in carrying her back to the entrance, then out into the foggy night. It was there, as he stared down at her, that he realized why she seemed so light a burden. Whatever had seized her in the darkness had not harmed her body. Limbs and torso were mercifully intact. But she no longer had a head.
He hates faces.
He hates faces.
Get rid of that face. Take the whole head off.
So Mark loses his mind at this point. He wanders around with her body for a while, and then he decides that he needs to get to the newspaper to report what's going on and what happened to Laurel. So LA is in a total disaster state. Everything's on fire. Buildings are falling down. I mean, this is like an insane earthquake, post-apocalyptic kind of stuff here.
Right.
But he's losing his mind, and he's not sure if any of this stuff is real.
And I wasn't sure if any was real because he does a lot of walking around the city and actually gets places. That seemed a little suspect.
He finally gets to the paper's building, but it's gone. It's just a huge column of smoke where the building used to be. He then thinks about Muybridge, and Mark has to see him again. And then he ends up at his house, and he's not exactly sure how he got there. He thinks some black guy gave him a ride in a car.
He's delusional about this journey, but he must have hitched a ride.
The house, when he gets there, has been ransacked. It's not just from the earthquake. It's stuff has been flipped out of drawers and as if somebody was looking for something. Yeah. And he finds the safe to the place has been opened. There's a ton of money in there, so the robbers weren't after that. But then he finds some microfilm that has notes on it, and it says Necronomicon.
I'm just, why is this even necessary at this point? It's like a scene where he's gathering more evidence or proof that this is all real. It's clearly all real. You know, I've read through two sections of this book.
But I did kind of like the setting of when everything's going crazy, like really crazy, total apocalyptic. Things are on fire. Buildings are falling down. There's nothing anymore. There's no civilization. It's just everything's madness. It's kind of cool.
I also thought it was cool that the Necronomicon was on microfiche or whatever it is. Microfiche.
Yeah.
I mean, because that would happen at some point, wouldn't it?
Yeah, of course. Why wouldn't it?
I mean, it gives it a little bit more of a spy edge.
So he goes out to the pool and he looks inside and there's a body in there. It's Muybridge. He's dead. He's all bloated and gross and stuff. And then he's grabbed by his legs and pulled into the water by something. And he feels his lungs fill with water and he dies and drowns. But for some reason, he's still thinking. He feels like he's dead, but he's not. Maybe he's a ghost and he's remembering his life.
Sure.
Or he's in the afterlife. He doesn't know. He's all crazy. But he comes to in the back seat of a car. Two fishy guys are right next to him. Deep One hybrids. I'm not going to, you know, he tries to dance around it by describing the Innsmouth look.
Yeah, but that's what they are.
But they're Deep One hybrids. They're driving around trying to find safe roads. He doesn't know where they're going. He kind of is in and out of consciousness. So he only gets bits and pieces of what is being said. They seem to be up near Santa Cruz in the mountains.
Yeah, it's a funny scene. I mean, they're going for a long drive here. The only time he really is conscious, he just hears the fishermen sort of arguing about directions with each other. It also fits with this theme that's been throughout the book of unconscious travel, you know?
What is that about?
I don't know. I'm going to start a travel service called Around the Block. Tired of bad airplane food and no room to stretch your legs? Well, at Around the Block, we just knock your ass out, so you don't have to be awake for any of it. Get handled by strangers today.
I see. It's Around the Block, B-L-O-C-H.
That's right.
As in Robert Block. That's the pun. I didn't get that.
Once you've been around the block a few times, you'll never travel in a normal way again.
So when he finally comes around, he's in a house in the mountains. He thinks, boy, these guys are like the people from Innsmouth. And then a voice says, Innsmouth was never real. And he's like, well, I didn't say that out loud, or did I? He keeps thinking things, and this voice keeps answering his questions. He thinks he's been abducted, and the voice corrects him and says, no, you've been conducted. And he's like, what, can you read my mind? And he goes, oh, no, not really. That's just a parlor trick.
It's a weird scene. There's a guy in the corner, some shadow of somebody.
He says if he could read minds, then Muybridge wouldn't have fooled him. But now he's dead, and he would have died anyway. The waters were rising. All of the West Coast is now in the water. And then Mark looks out the window and sees, yeah, now he's by an ocean, even though there should be no ocean there.
Yeah, they're up in the mountains, and the ocean is right there. I thought that was pretty neat, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So the man introduces himself. He's Nyarlathotep. He explains that after what happened 25 years ago, they had to discredit Lovecraft and the truth. If people believed it, they would pursue it and try to find it. And that's what the Black Brotherhood was for. He helped destroy all the books and kill all the people in the know while things are prepared for the return of Cthulhu.
And without Lovecraft's fiction, the government wouldn't have known to go nuclear on Cthulhu the first time. They got some information from Lovecraft there. So that's why they had to ban the books and get ready for this next shot.
So the stars are right. It has come to pass. Like, it's going on right now. So Nye pulls out the box. The trapezohedron's in there. Its power dazzles and freezes Mark. Nye says that the trapezohedron is many things. It's a tool, a key, a gate. It heals and destroys. It also has the power to change things. He explains that night on Easter Island, even Cthulhu could not withstand the nuclear assault. Mark asks if Cthulhu is dead, and Nye doesn't answer. But he says two escaped the island, Kay, Keith, and himself. Nye himself delivered the child. Kay died during childbirth. And Mark asks, what child? Nye tells him the union was consummated before the bombers arrived. So the child was given to the nephew of the man who managed her estate. That was Heisinger, remember from the other part of the book.
Right.
His nephew is Muybridge. The seed of Cthulhu has survived, says Nyarlathotep. And Mark never suspected it. He never thought he was any different than anybody else. But now he feels a change from the light, something this trapezohedron's doing to him. And he knew the old ones were coming back, all of them, and the Migo would soon arrive in mass, and it was all happening. And then Mark moved.
He stirred, and the walls surrounding him splintered and fell forward. He breathed, and Nyarlathotep vanished into nothingness, clutching the tiny toy that was the trapezohedron. He waved, and the waters below surged upward, boiling and beckoning. He rose, and mountains trembled, sinking into the sea. Time stopped. Death died. And great Cthulhu went forth into the world to begin his eternal reign.
And that's the end.
That's the end. They fed Cthulhu up, but then the government was able to nuke him. And so his strategy was to be reborn as his own son.
Yeah.
Which I guess makes sense mythologically. Things like that happen.
Sure.
Feels like it's going to be, you know, Cthulhu Jr. Like he'll have a little, he'll be a sassy kind of like, this isn't your dad's Cthulhu. Skateboarding and...
Yeah, it's just, it's, I don't know, Kid Cthulhu's a little...
Kid Cthulhu.
It's not there for me. I just like the idea that Cthulhu is more unknowable. That, I don't know, it feels quantified for some reason at this point that, you know, that he has human offspring. Why is he limited in that way? Like,
I don't know.
The nuke gets him. Why? Why does the nuke have to get him? I guess just prolong the story to provide some danger.
Yeah, so that you can then have this human monster hybrid birth that has been hit. You know, he's brought that up so many times in the book. That was his big conclusion.
Yeah.
I guess the way to one up, well, it's, guess what? It's not the deep ones who did it this time. It's the Big C himself.
Yeah.
That makes the bigger monster seem stupid. I mean, he had a wedding, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, Cthulhu's scary till you see, you know, his wife shoving cake in his face. Not scary anymore.
Anything where something that is all powerful has limitations.
Yeah.
Just kind of stinks. It's not scary anymore to me. It's quantifiable.
But let's not pretend this book was meant to be or was ever going to be really that scary.
No, of course not. No, yeah. I'm not trying to put on airs.
So it was a weird thing to go out with, but why not?
Yeah, why not? And honestly, I said it once, but I really enjoyed this book. It's a fun read. It's super fast. It's total cotton candy. It tastes really sweet. It goes in your mouth and just dissolves right away.
There was lots of hints about people prolonging their life unnaturally in the book, too. So I thought another conclusion that would have been just as sensical would be if Lovecraft, all old, you know, showed up on a boat. It's Lovecraft. He's here to save us all. And then he punched Cthulhu out. And that was the end.
That would have been awesome. That
would have been a good one, too.
Unfortunately, that did not happen. I want to thank Andrew Lehman for taking this material. That's in quotes, if you can see that. And making it gold.
As he always does, he's a great reader. Thanks, Andrew, so much for doing the show this month. And as always, go to hplhs.org to see what's on offer at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society.
And I also want to thank Repairer of Reputations for their amazing music.
We've been listening to selections from the Night Ocean all month, and they've certainly helped to elevate the material. And we really sure appreciate that. Thanks so much. And go to Bandcamp and check that album out. It's a good one. Also want to thank some of our patrons.
Oh my gosh, you people, you're awesome. I want to thank Ada Terrell.
I want to thank Kevin Roy.
Jeff C. Carter. Hey, Jeff.
Jeff, I love you, Jeff.
Eric Otterberg.
Mark O. Martin. Aw, hey, Mark.
Andy Lee.
Bennett.
Like share. Chris Weigen.
S.J. Patterson.
Jeffrey Sumler.
And Francine.
Aw, Francine.
Thank you so much, guys, for being part of the team. You make all of this possible. Also, just wanted to mention that Frankenstein's Monster will be performing at the Pechanga Resort and Casino this October, although I can't reveal the exact date. It's going to be a great show, though. He'll be appearing with Lying Vincent Price, who tells true Hollywood stories from his long and amazing career, and The Lost Wolfman, which is another character that I didn't give any time to last week, but that's just a naked guy asking everybody where he is. That's his routine. The Lost Wolfman. I don't know where I am. Can you help me? But then he does, because he's just naked. Next month, I'm not sure what we're going to do yet, but we're figuring that out right now. But we will announce soon over the social medias and the patrons and all that business.
Yeah.
What we'll be reading in November. Also, of course, you've got the good bonus content and comments shows to listen to this month. Happy Halloween, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.